Hi, I'm Danny Elfman.
This is Shirley Manson.
This is Debbie Harry.
This is Chris Steyer Blondie.
This is Ronan Dorzabal from Tears for Fears.
This is Billy Idol.
This is Alex Ebert, a.k.a. Edward Sharp, giving the story behind the song.
Hi, this is Peter Chotti, host of The Story Behind the Song. Each month I speak to some of music's biggest artists to get the inside stories behind their most lasting and iconic songs. Join me for new episodes on the third Monday of every month on The Story Behind the Song from the Consequence Podcast Network, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, pod people, Engineer Adam here, jumping in for a quick second to let you know about the brand new all-in-one platform for all of you creative podcasters out there. Anchor makes it easier than ever to make a podcast. It's free to use and has all the creation tools you need to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Plus, Anchor will get your podcast set up on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are found. Even better, Anchor helps you connect with sponsors, even if you're just starting out. It's the perfect choice for podcasters, so make sure to check it out. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. That's anchor.fm. Back to the show.
He's been shot 6 times. Halloweenies. He's been burned alive. Halloweenies. He's lost his head. Halloweenies. Michael Myers can't and won't be stopped, which is why he returns this October. In anticipation, the Consequence Podcast Network presents Halloweenies, a limited series that carves out one Halloween movie a month, leading all the way up to the October 19th release of David Gordon Green and Danny McBride's new movie. You'll get tricks. You'll get treats. You'll get Michael. Tune in for the night we came home.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hello and Happy New Year to all of you wonderful pod people out there. I am your host, Leo Phillips, and this is another episode, the most important episode of This Must Be The Gig, your little backstage pass to the world of live music. Each week, we strive to bring you a fascinating conversation from the beating heart of the live music and performance world. And that could obviously mean chatting to musicians about it, a founder of a festival you love, a choreographer, a comedian, an actor, anyone really obsessed with live music the way that we are. I'm coming to you from the start of a fresh new year. We're celebrating the beginning of 2019 by obviously looking back. That's what you do, don't you? Who cares about New Year's resolutions when you can look back on 2018, an exceptionally tense and stupefying year on many fronts? But really, the beginning is the most important part of the work. Who said that? I think Plato said that. I feel like somebody said that. Somebody important said that. So we're celebrating and looking at some of the best music moments and the most incredible conversations that we had in 2018 on the show. It felt kind of weird just to get going in 2019 with a brand new bunch of amazing chats. We thought that we just need to give one more little nod and a little look-see, a little look back, a little rewind, be kind rewinding at our little almost greatest hits compilation. And before we dig in to all of this wonderful collection of work that we have amassed over the last year, I can't believe it's already been a year, let's check in with our constant companion here, our CC at TMBTG Studios. Hello, Adam.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. I'm really good.
It's
the new year.
We brought Pod Puppy Buffy into the studio for one more 2018 woof back. We're ringing out 2018 with Pod Puppy Buffy.
Exactly.
But there anyway, should I start singing Auld Lang Syne to ring in 2019?
I mean, I don't know if that's the best.
No, sorry.
It's a super fun jam.
Yeah. I was doing a really good job of showcasing how high energy and pump up that song is.
I just watched Beyonce's compilation of her year, and it's basically like having a panic attack, but with somebody like rubbing your shoulders, because it's basically on Instagram, it's a video flashing her entire year, and you think, how can God do so much. But really, though, how has she done so much? It flashed before my eyes and then it would slow motion into the most important times. So it was like, and then slow motion Lion King. And then, and then slow motion her singing with her little daughter. I mean, it was great.
And on one hand, you're like, what have I done this year? I'm so frustrated. But then on the other hand, you're just like, how can creation like this exist?
I never do that. I also think that people who don't congratulate themselves or others, or people who aren't inspired what other people have done, whether that's just overcome a slight small fear or traveled the world, I still don't think people should be envious. Being around people who are growing is the most important thing for growth.
That's an incredible sentiment. Yeah, I love that.
That wasn't Plato.
No, that was you.
That was Mato. But anyway, let's go back, as always, reel it in. Since it's the subject of our podcast, did you have a favorite concert of 2018?
I got to see Grouper, who is one of my all-time favorites.
Yes.
Perform at the Bohemian National Cemetery here in Chicago, which absolutely mind-blowing.
I can only imagine.
They host shows there a few times a year in Chicago. If you happen to be here during one of the solstices, I highly recommend going. It's incredible.
How do you feel about feeling emotionally high and haunted at the same time?
Oh, I didn't think I was haunted. Am I haunted now?
I mean, you're lurking in a cemetery. That's I kind true. Of feel like you're asking for haunts.
But there are a lot of people there. Are we all haunted?
Absolutely. Oh, you're gosh. Carrying other people with. No, that is very scary. I don't ever want to entertain that concept. But I think it's very difficult always to quantify the amount of concerts that I see for work and then qualify the heart emotion reaction that I get from concerts. So there's so many, but the one that I thought of right now when you asked the question was definitely the heart thumping motherfucking crazy Yeah's performance in Montreal that I got to see. They've obviously been one of my favorite for a long time, and Carano is just a hero. And I think that was definitely a standout, just because I think I'd never been to Montreal before. Everybody was kind of, seemed like the crowd was just tired, and then they electrified the crowd.
Yeah, that's, you cannot.
Electrocuted.
Whoa. You cannot be calm at a Yeah show.
No, but it's a level of like, you know that you are in good hands.
Oh, yeah.
That is what I wanted to say.
No, absolutely.
It took me a long time to get there. But I was trying to think back and be genuine and honest about it. But I also think, talking about Carano, I did see other really worldly icons like Elton John and Pearl Jam loads of times this year in different countries around the world, which is also so strange. I got to shoot them at Wrigley Field. And even though they aren't at the top of my all-time favorites, there was something about seeing all these icons and then also getting to shoot them for the first times, some of them, mm-hmm. was really important. So there were a lot of firsts, a lot of tents, but those, and obviously I love Florence and the Machine's latest show, David Byrne's latest show.
Oh man.
I loved Hormonar, which is one of my favorite Icelandic bands.
That's one of our Icelandic secrets.
Uh-huh. Well, not anymore.
Yeah, tell everyone.
I have many Icelandic secrets and no one will find any of them out, because then tourists will flock. And who else? I just wanted to think.
I remember you ranting about Young Fathers.
Of course. Who? We won't mention anything.
We won't, but we will spoil say, a future episode.
There's an episode coming.
Get ready.
I also feel like seeing No Name and seeing a few of my favorite albums of the year, seeing that performed live.
Absolutely.
Like Mitski, and I didn't get to see Robin, although that is one of my favorite albums of the year, Honey. Micaiah McRaven played also in Chicago for the Red Bull Music Festival. Christine and the Queens. Who else? Just so many. Boy Genius.
Oh, boy.
And then obviously Kamasi Washington, Heaven and Earth. And the last time I saw him was when his father came on stage. Maybe his father comes on stage all the time.
You know, I've only seen him once and he did. So at least I can vouch for that.
But that's also a fantastic, fantastic album.
You've seen so many live shows this year.
So have you.
Yes,
so have all the
true.
People listening.
And it's just amazing to be able to share these experiences.
I know. And I also love to find out the ones that people were the most surprised by, because there's a lot of shows that we really look forward to. And then we get to them and either we've had a crappy day or somebody's shoving us in the back or there's an asshole talking next to us or there's just not enough people crying, because we always want people crying. But there's a lot of shitty things that happen at festivals and live shows that I think people are very quick to forget about. So if anything ruined a show you went to see, I hope and I pray that my... Actually, you know what? There's my New Year's resolution. That your way forward is that you get to see that artist again without that mean-spirited lunatic speaking in your ear behind you.
I love that. I just get kicked in the shins so much at concerts.
Yeah, but you're tall.
Yeah, that's the problem. I'm in people's way. I don't mean to be.
Cut your legs off.
I don't mean to be in people's way. You don't have to kick me. I'm sorry.
I also love going right up front, which is the opposite of what most journalists, I think, want to do. Because they just always want to hang back. The sound's better back here. And we all know it is not. We all know it's not. Also, half of what I do needs to... The people around me need to filter into it. Because they are what makes it.
You have to feel the experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Feel the experience. So, in order for you to feel the experience with us...
We decided to take some samples from our first year as a podcast. Mm-hmm. We grabbed... snippets of conversations from some of the most incredible musicians that we had on the show for this year, talking about their first concert, the way they experienced that moment.
And we have obviously so many thrilling conversations coming to you in 2019. I don't know how I'm going to write 2019. It just doesn't look right. How do you even write 9? 8 was in my life for so long.
But even before we get into those incredible moments, I want to encourage you to leave us a note, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, at TMBTGpod.
TMBTGpod.
Anyone, leave your best concert experience as a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, and we'll shout you out. You listen on Spotify? Subscribe there. You listen on your iPhone? Subscribe on Apple Podcasts.
You listen on the Googles?
Listen surprise, on the Googles.
Surprise on the Googles.
Surprise on the Googles.
But before we get into our first story, I do also want to say thank you to every single person who's been listening. Every time I hear a podcast host say this, I roll my eyes in shame. But I have to say it, because if I don't, then I'll just regret not saying thank you. I'm very grateful, and I'm sure... Adam and Pod Puppy are very grateful as well.
We are.
And here at Consequence Podcast Network, we are all so happy to have you along for the journey and the ride. And you're there when we're airing out all the kinks and we're listening to the kinks. And you're right there with us. And so thank you.
That's a beautiful sentiment yet again. You really have a great heart.
Thanks. Yeah. Are we just being grateful?
Yeah, absolutely. This
you
is
have a great
this
heart
is
too.
2019. Oh my God.
So we'd be absolutely silly not to start off with the mind that gave us the namesake for the show. That's right. First up on our greatest hits, we have a sample of my chat with David Byrne, the David Byrne, living legend, idol, hero.
Seeing you interview David was such a special moment. Something I know you'd been dreaming of back even before we started thinking about this podcast.
Special as in my quivering.
Yes.
Was special.
Yes. Yeah. I could see you vibrating.
Yeah, it's true. I jumped off a plane from a festival that I was covering in Europe, and I rushed from the airport to the venue in Chicago that he'd be playing that evening. I was a little frazzled and a little nervous, but then we proceeded to have the most wonderful, wonderful, wonderful chat with David and Annie B. Parson as well, who is so inspiring in everything that she really lays her eyes and ears and touch on.
In this little clip you're going to get, David discusses the first concert that he ever went to when his father took him to see Ravi Shankar, which is a pretty badass first concert, if you ask me. And then after that, the two of you discussed the first times David himself ever performed when he was freaking out folkies at the coffee shop.
I mean, talk about life-changing moments, both David's and mine, obviously. Who else is all about the for getting to be obviously in the room with him and Annie B, and she choreographed the movements for David's band on his most recent tour and yet another of my favorite concerts of the year, as I mentioned earlier. So here is a little sample of episode 9 with David Byrne and Annie B. Parson. Enjoy! What was your first concert? What was
my
the
first concert? For me?
Yeah, that you saw.
My dad took me to see Ravi Shankar. Is that cool?
That's so cool.
Is that cool?
That's amazing. But I love that you are saying, is that cool? Yes, we're all like...
That's cool.
That's super cool. How old were you?
So I remember, I mean, music is wonderful, but I remember like there was a big, you know, big carpet on the stage and flowers.
Oh, yeah.
Things like that.
Yeah.
It wasn't like amplifiers and stuff like that. It was a carpet and maybe some pillows and some flowers around the edge. And I thought, oh, that's how they make the stage for this kind of show.
Yeah. Now, do you remember how old you were at the time when you saw?
I was probably about... 13, 14, something like that,
Did you know that was it? Was that when you saw that?
Oh, it was...
Did you know that you wanted to do that?
Yes. I mean...
Immediately?
Yeah, it was a cool thing to do.
Just perform?
For me to perform.
Yeah.
I started performing at an early age. I was very, very shy, but I would also perform.
Mm.
And for a lot of people, that seems like a contradiction. But for me, it was a way to communicate. It was a way to announce my being, here I am. But then as soon as I finished performing, I would go back in the corner and not talk to anyone.
How did you get out of that?
I think music helped me. Music and performing helped me.
What was your first ever performance that you did?
I don't know which was the first. I used to perform in... they were called coffee houses, and they didn't serve liquor, and they often had folk singers. And I think I would go in with maybe a guitar, but it was usually a ukulele, and then sometimes a violin. I had a violin, and I played sometimes rock songs on the ukulele, and other things on the violin. It was terrible. And
I mean,
something else.
It
might have been a guitar as well, but And it was a performance. It was playing with their expectations of this folk crowd, too, who did not expect that kind of stuff.
So looking back, it really makes so much sense. The little spiritual tenor of David's music, the almost romantic theatrics, the meditative thoughtfulness...
Another person who thrives on that same thoughtful, is a good word for it, vibration, is from our very first episode with garbage front person, Shirley Manson.
Oh my gosh, I've spoken with Shirley many times over the years, and her mind and her laugh and her heart never really cease to amaze.
And while that episode features so much really incisive commentary and dissection of what it is to be a performer in this moment, in this second... It was really wonderful to see the nostalgia of her calling back to her childhood and really bringing you into that.
And it's really, really good and comforting to know that a person that bold and powerful could be kind of embarrassed by their mom still. When young Shirley was walking alongside Joe Strummer in Edinburgh, and we also got to chat about Shirley's first memories of seeing her mom sing and the inspiration that she got from that experience.
So here's a little clip from episode 1, the very first episode of the year, with Shirley Manson.
So do you have favorite concert that you went to when you were super young? Like, when was the first concert? How available were acts coming into your hometown? Like, did you get a lot of acts touring, or did you actively have to go get in a car with your mates and watch your favorite band?
No, I was pretty lucky. Almost everything came through Edinburgh in the end. Mm. Anyone really that I pretty much wanted to see, I ended up in some way or form getting to witness them in the flesh. You know, I can remember walking down Princess Street, which is the main drag in Edinburgh, with my mum.
Yes.
And Joe Strummer is walking along the street and towards
no.
us.
Oh, my
and
gosh.
My fucking mum notices that I'm blushing because I'm so, like, taken by the fact that he's there in, he's the physical manifestation of Joe Strummer is in my hometown. He's walking towards me, and my mum looks at me, and just as he passes by in earshot, says, "Why are you blushing? You're bright red."
Oh, no.
And I just remember thinking, "Oh, mum, shut the fuck up.
Mum, go jump you know, down the well right now, mum. Leave me alone."
Yeah.
And then I
remember also like an amazing memory of like running up the Waverley Steps, which is in Edinburgh, and Bjork was running down on her way to the train station. You know, shit like that.
No.
It's like really beautiful, extraordinary glimpses of these incredible artists, you know, in sort of anonymity in a funny way. It was really extraordinary. But arguably my first musical concert was my mum. My mum was singing. And
really? Wow.
So she was
in a band?
Well, she was in a band, but I didn't see her sing with her band. I saw her sing in the sort of concert party that was attached to the church that we used to go to when we were kids. And I heard my mum sing there for the first time with the concert party. And my little sister and I were just talking about this yesterday, actually. It's like we both remember sitting there and watching her appear out of blue velvet curtains. They had these thick blue velvet curtains that they used to, like, literally manually turn. You know, somebody had a sort
yeah,
of like
squeaky,
a,
like
yeah squeaky wheel, and these blue curtains opened up, and there was my mum in a beautiful white dress with little blue cornflowers on them, and she sang On a Clear Day. And me and my sisters were just sort of mesmerized.
Did that kind of give you an idea of what you wanted to do? Was that in terms of not necessarily making music, but performing to...
You know, I was a strange little creature, to be honest. And I have an argument with my family because I claim that I never wanted to be famous or be a singer or be on the stage or anything. They claim otherwise. They said, "No, you always wanted to be famous. You always said you wanted to be famous." And I don't remember that streak in myself at all. I mean, I literally have zero memory of having any desire. I wanted to be a ballerina. That's what I wanted to do. And I was very serious about that. And it's the only thing, actually, to be honest, in my life I've ever pursued with real passion and seriousness. I really desperately wanted to dance like Margot Fonteyn, and I injured myself when I was young, and I also got too tall, and that was the end of that. But that was really the only dream I've ever had.
So the list of legends continues after that fantastic moment with another, this time courtesy of Johnny Marr, the co-founder of the Smiths. Johnny called in while he was standing on the roof of his recording studio, which I just thought was wonderful. The whole thing seemed very appropriate for the wild stories that he shared.
Again, this one features a double dose of storytelling in that you get a little bit of the past, a little bit of the present, and also he talks about the very first gigs he saw, including Rod Stewart, which was a bit of a surprise, and also local rock bands, but then also the runaway drug-fueled trips that those rock shows led to.
And he follows that with an absolutely crazy memory of the very first gig the Smiths ever performed, which was at a friend's fashion show at the Ritz in Manchester, a story that somehow reels in poet William Burroughs as well, which is nuts.
So enjoy this clip from episode 17 with Johnny Marr.
Do you remember when that first time was that you played? Was it in Manchester, or do you remember when the first ever gig was?
Yeah, I remember it vividly. It was at a place called the Ritz, which is still open, and which, in fact, is quite a... It's quite a prestigious venue, the Ritz.
Yeah.
And it was all a bit of a ruse actually, because our friends who were quite enterprising, two of our friends put on a sort of night of kind of, this was around the, what was known as the New Romantic kind of age. So everybody, you know, was dressed up in togas and all this kind of finery. And they put on what was called a fashion show, which was, yeah, it was local designers and our old friends modeling. And around this fashion show, they put on a few bands and we were the first band on. But essentially, the night was really devised as a kind of showcase for my new band.
Oh, wow.
And we went on and we did four songs, and we had Morrissey's friend as a go-go dancer, this guy James Maker stood in stilettos.
Yeah.
God knows why he was doing that.
Were you just like, oh yeah, I'm gonna go with this is great, I'm just
I thought, well, this is very exotic. I didn't really expect it was gonna last too long. But it didn't. So we did that, and I think because we were sort of I think even though we only did four songs and we were playing to the kind of very hip cognoscenti of Manchester, William Burroughs was on about 600 yards in the Hacienda, as it was then, down the road.
Oh, wow.
So most of the audience who we would have wanted to see us were watching William Burroughs croak his way through some narrative.
Oh, God, that's really why you had your go-go dancer in stilettos and playing four songs. I love that.
Exactly, yeah. But we arrived that night. We arrived because there was a lot of people who kind of knew that I was, you know, I was going to do something interesting. And partly they knew that because I'd been telling them that for about 2 years. And, you know, there was a few people around who were aware of Morrissey's reputation from the punk days.
Yes.
And so we stirred up a little bit of attention. And
who was the first artist then that you saw perform live?
Absolutely. Well, I wrote my autobiography in... In 2016. And in doing the research, I knew that I'd seen Rod Stewart really early with my uncle. But I also had seen, there was a local band in Manchester who became a punk band. They were called Slaughter and the Dogs. Mm-hmm. And they were quite, they were a notorious local band of kind of hoodlums, really. But they were pretty good for a time before they changed to punk. They were the local kind of heroes. And so in writing their biography, I went back and I had the ticket.
Oh, wow.
It turns out I went to that gig on my own in 1976, and I was 12. Vividly, I remember every second of it. And what really struck me was that actually that I went on my own to check this band out, and almost as research in a way, because I started kind of playing at 11. And it was very violent. I mean, those gigs were known for being violent. And it was absolutely astonishing. And I stood sort of on the periphery of the fray. And I remember I watched the whole gig. And I hung around to sort of soak up the atmosphere afterwards. And I walked, I guess, maybe the 8 miles, 9 miles back on my own. But the thing is, I realized I must have got in about after midnight anyway. Mm. And what struck me about that was that my parents just let me do it.
I was just thinking, how did your parents even firstly let you out the house at that age alone, and then also let you come back so late? Were they kind of confident that you just weren't going to, I don't know, disappear or?
Well, that was the start of me. Because I was the oldest. I am the oldest of an Irish family. And Irish descent, and back then, particularly, there was a very sort of trusting or loose The parents were kind of loose about where I went, really. That's the honest answer. And they were okay with giving me a hell of a lot of independence. I mean, that kind of bit them very quickly after that. That came back to bite them when I would disappear for a few days. And then Kate would back with my eyes rolling around in my head like saucers, having ingested all kinds of substances. But yeah. And that's when then it started to cause quite a few problems.
Absolutely love the fact that somewhere there must be a person whose very first gig was getting to see Johnny Marr or Morrissey and the Smiths play at a fashion show. If you saw that show, let us know.
Hit us up.
That's just the beauty of live music, I suppose, and live performance in all. Magic can really happen at any moment, and you can absolutely be a part of it and experience it.
That's something that became really readily apparent in your conversation with Flaming Lips frontman Wayne Coyne as well.
So Wayne, as most of you know, can also reel off into crazy tangents, and you just got to jump on and grab the rope and fly on by with him and his wild stories. And this episode is a real thrill ride, and I wanted to just make sure that we highlight Wayne's classic rock origin story, which is so great.
His stories of having his life changed by seeing The Who as a child, which,
man.
There's so many people that are just hungering for that experience, not to mention sitting on the stage for ELO. That's the kind of live music miracle that kids today are dreaming of.
Kids today? Old man.
Well.
Gee whiz, grandpa.
It's true, though.
It's true. I feel like there's a lot of obvious... you have an icon who's obviously inspired by another icon, but because it's like a babushka doll of icons, you just feel very overwhelmed. So I just think it's amazing to just sit back and listen to these stories. So here's a clip from episode 24 with me and Wayne. Enjoy.
When I'm going all through my early teenage years, you know, at the end of the early 70s, my older brothers are going to virtually every concert. You know, the only groups that we didn't see in the day would have been just like the Beatles and Pink Floyd. I mean, we saw everybody else, Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, you know, all
that.
But the one that I think absolutely blew my mind, and I was young anyway, I was only 16, was seeing The Who.
Oh my gosh.
They were still, you know, they were still with the Keith Moon and the John Entwistle, and they were, to me, they were very potent and like religious and just insanely, like they had an optimism and an energy, and I just didn't understand it. And I'd seen a lot of concerts before then, and I kind of had an idea, like, I kind of know what this, you know, I think I know what this is or whatever. And then seeing them was just a different level. And I think I was right. I still believe seeing The Who in that time, in the early 70s, to the till when Keith Moon dies, there's just some insane like connection that they have when they're playing. That's about energy and emotion and all that. And I think it's true. I don't think I was tricked by it. And so I think that it being The Who and not being, I don't know why, but The Who just sort of seemed like more of a working class group. Mm. I didn't know that at the time. I mean, it didn't matter to me at the time, but I think because I started to believe in their thing so much, I started to recognize, oh, this is like working class. That's, you know, it's not, these aren't artists and these aren't musicians. This is like just dudes. And I was wrong. I mean, there are artists and musicians of the
But I understand high what you're saying. Yeah. More relatable. Yeah. Yeah. I understand.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
if you're talking about that era, that must have been like, was that the Who's Next album era and Generation era? I mean, that those albums, even listening to them, you know, can set you onto a different path than it would another artist. So I love that you also got to experience that when you were 16, because you're brain's forming, your personality's forming, and you're at that prime where music sticks with you in a way that it doesn't really,
you know, stick with you when you're getting older. You know, when you're younger, it's your formative years. It's like the music.
And
yeah,
I think there was some sort of, and I say religious, but I think it's more like that communal love and that energy. And I didn't really, I mean, my brothers and other friends took drugs. They just took drugs all the time, but I really never did. And so I think my young mind was just so completely absorbent to everything that was going on. And that little energy, that communal energy, I tell this story a lot because I'd been just the previous night before, the night before seeing The Who in Oklahoma City, I'd gone to see Bachman Turner Overdrive and Electric Light Orchestra. And they were playing on the same bill.
Oh my gosh.
Back then, it would be like a general admission thing, and we would get there early enough, and we would be at the absolute
front
of the stage.
Yeah.
I had literally sat on the stage with ELO. I literally sat there on the stage. It wasn't a barricade or anything back then. I remember seeing the Rush and Ted Nugent and all them, and there would be no barricade or anything. And like I said, there was a sense of like, I kind of know what this is, but when The Who played, it just had this extra thing, and I questioned everybody. I was like, well, what did they do that was different? And my brothers, with their wisdom, would just be like, well, they're The Who. They're, you know, that's why they're The Who. You know, there's no real answer, you know? And so I think that my mind getting so zapped by that intangible, like, what was that thing that they created? It wasn't just music. It wasn't just this. It's that communal energy. And I think that's very much part of the urge that's happening when the Flaming Lips play. It's
absolutely
not just to say, we're playing our music and I think it's sounding good or whatever. It's to make that connection, you know, to really feel that thing. And so, yeah, and you know, there'd be no way that when I'm 16, I would know what that is, or even maybe I don't even know what it is now. But there's that feeling of like, I think it's that. I think this is what it's about, you know. And so, yeah, I mean, I would always, from the day that happened, the night that happened, it's always been with me. And 31 years later, in that same auditorium, backstage in Oklahoma City, I met Pete Townsend.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow. So for the last of our greatest hits moments, I wanted to call out a fantastic conversation with someone with whom I share a passion for Gwen Stefani and No Doubt with. In episode 5, I chatted with Speedy Ortiz frontwoman Sadie Dupuy about everything from the dog that was named after her to taking her mom to her very first house show. But first and foremost, obviously, we bonded over No Doubt.
Sadie details her experience getting to see No Doubt as a teen. You guys run through the whole set list from that show, which is an incredible thing that we now have at our fingertips, thanks to the internet. Thank you, internet, for making set lists always available. But you also discuss everything that there is about the band, even the interesting view, let's say, she got from the balcony of drummer Adrian Young, who seems to perpetually not be wearing much clothing.
I mean, what drummer does? No Doubt.
Hey.
But No Doubt was obviously one of my favorites as a teen. I say obviously very confidently because you all should know that already. And I have absolutely loved to be able to see them. I would have absolutely loved to be able to see them at any age instead of just staring longingly at every CD cover and unfolding the. I remember that was the first thing I ever did when I got any CD of theirs. I used to take it out of the sleeve and unfold it and then read through each thing and even comment on the colors they used.
What about all those music videos too? They had some great
ones. They were wonderful. So getting to live that experience through this conversation was quite therapeutic and very calming.
So this is our last greatest hit moment from 2018. Volume 1 complete. Here's Lior and Sadie Dupuy. Enjoy.
Thanks for listening again and see you next week for our first edition of 2019, who we shall not name just yet. You'll have to just tune in again and see. Bye. What was your very, very first concert?
Well, I definitely went to stuff when I was like a little baby before I remember. Like, I know that they, because I grew up in New York City, so we went to like Summer Stage is a series they do in Central Park. And I remember seeing like Sheryl Crow when I was pretty little. But the first show that I remember like asking my parents to take me to, which I realized today, we're recording this April 6th. It was April 6th in the year 2000.
So 18 years ago, wow.
I made my mom take me and two of my best friends to see No Doubt at the Roseland Ballroom. And right before, they were like my favorite band. And had been.
My favorite band too.
Had been since Tragic Kingdom. So
favorite band. You know, yeah.
From like 1995 until that point, that was my favorite band.
The bass band.
I was like 11, I guess. I would have turned 12 that year, but wow. Not yet. So we went to go see them right before Return of Saturn came out. And that was my first like club show. And it was amazing. I looked it up today because I was like, I wonder if the set list is online. And I found it.
Oh my God, is the set list online?
I'm
actually going to look at it now.
I had to dig into like a blog entry about the Roseland Ballroom closing to find it. But I can send you it. I found the set list.
Please send it to me. Or you can do have it in front of you now.
I do. Yeah, yeah. Do you want to hear it?
Oh my God. Yes, obviously. Obviously. I love No Doubt.
They opened with New, which was
one of the greatest of that album.
And I remember buying the Go soundtrack as that was on it.
I love that movie.
They did Sunday Morning. They did Bathwater.
Which is also great.
Different. Magic's in the Makeup. Just a Girl. Comforting Lie. They did a lot of like slower, like sadder songs from Return of Saturn, which is funny. They did Marry Me. They did Happy Now. They did Total Hate, which I love. And I wonder who like sang the like Bradley Nowell part, but they did Staring Problem. I don't remember that at all. Yeah. They did Don't Speak. They did Ex-Girlfriend.
I love that song. I hated it when I first heard it, but then I got into it. It was because
of the Ex-Girlfriend?
Yeah, I hated it first, but then obviously it fits so well on the album. I can't remember. I think it was the first song on that album on Return to Saturn. I need to look it up.
I think it was his first single too. And it was one of the first songs I learned on guitar actually.
Oh my gosh.
Because I started learning guitar like right after this record came out. And I remember buying the like tablature book of all the songs. And then the encore, they did Simple Kind of Life and Spiderwebs. So
loved
amazing set list. And Adrian would always he would spit during the shows, like down to like a thong. I remember we were in the balcony of the Roseland Ballroom. We had like, my mom had also worked in the music industry, and she like a little bit different than my dad, but she had always had friends who still worked at all the clubs in Manhattan. So for some reason, I think we had VIP tickets. So we were up in the balcony, like right by the stage, right. And I remember I could basically see Adrian from the side, and you could see his penis. And it was like the first time. I mean, I was like 11. I had not seen one of those. And I was like,
like
a little freaked out.
Yeah, like almost expect, okay, now every time somebody plays drums, you'll have to see that. I'm like surprised you weren't like scarred for life.
Yeah, it was a lot. But it was amazing. So that was my first club show.
This Must Be the Gig is produced by Adam Kivel, and we'd like to thank Billy Yost and The Kickback for our theme song, Rube, and buy their music at thekickbackband.com, Lexi Frame for the artwork, Daniel Brater and Dean Berger for the additional sound design, and the Consequence Podcast Network, where you'll find a bunch of other amazing shows. If you've listened this far, why not go the extra mile and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your podcasts? Your comments provide valuable feedback for us, and it helps other people find us too. For information on new episodes, be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at TMBTGpod, and generally just irritate everyone you know about the show. Thanks again, and I miss you already.
Consequence Podcast Network.